generally speaking, you can find the money to get it done. If I had my choice between vision and money, I'd take vision.
This is episode 302 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I'm Lisa Gonzalez. A few weeks ago, Christopher sat down with his old friend, Gary Evans, who's a retired president and CEO of Hiawatha Broadband Communications. They had a great conversation about the company and life as a small independent ISP for episode 297, but there was still so much to cover. Gary and Christopher are at the mics again to continue their conversation about Hiawatha Broadband Communications. They're talking about the challenges the company's faced and overcome and prospects for the future. Once again, this interview is a little longer than our usual podcasts, but we know you'll be glad we kept it that way. There's lessons to be learned and interesting stories to hear. Now here's Christopher with Gary Evans.
Welcome back to another episode of the Community Broadband Bits podcast. I'm Chris Mitchell with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance up in St. Paul, Minnesota. I guess our office is technically in Minneapolis, but I'm a St. Paul boy myself. I'm here with Gary Evans once again, the still retired founder of HBC.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be back.
We talked a few weeks ago and you said you have a habit of not staying retired for long, but thus far.
Well, I'm doing some work that I'm really loving. For a private equity firm in New York City that's concentrating in the area of fiber optics.
Okay.
And so another way, hopefully, to help rural America, because we're going to be looking at markets that the big players don't seem to have much interest in today.
Well, I think that's a good place to pick up where we left off. Last time, we mainly talked about the history of HBC. And one of the key lessons that we took away is that there is a very strong business model in connecting the areas that Wall Street has tended to overlook, the smaller towns in America. Not necessarily the tiniest ones, but the decent-sized ones that are very common.
You know, that's exactly right. And for me, at least, it seems you can make a case even for the tiniest if you have a nucleus of the not so tiny, not the tier one markets, but the Winonas at 35,000 and the Red Wings at 25,000 allow you to pick up a community like Minnesota, which when we built it was 68 dwelling units. They had a problem. They didn't have any emergency warning system that was effective. And so one of the things we did there was to collaborate with the city to put warning devices connected to the network in each of the homes.
So last Wednesday, as we're recording this 2 days ago, the first Wednesday of the month in Minnesota, they probably got some kind of a warning there.
They probably did because everybody got dumped on, at least in this part of the state.
Right. Well, those are also the tornado warnings I was thinking of, which I think is a very big deal around here.
Oh, it is. It's huge. And that was actually the motivating factor that drove them. I was really pleased when we were able to work that out. We had fiber running from Winona to Wabasha, and dropping off at Minnesota, for instance, was not a difficult thing to do.
Probably an afternoon job, right?
Right. And because we were leveraging resources back in Winona as well, we were able to add that without, you know, more than the cost of the connectivity to the home. So it was a nice thing to do.
Well, if anyone missed our first episode, I strongly encourage you to go back and listen to the episode in which we started talking about HBC, because I'd like to pick up with one of the things we didn't get to, which is how HBC has helped to run other networks. And I think it makes sense to start chronologically with what I think was the first one of this sort, which was Monticello, which is a community northwest west of Minneapolis. It's a little bit of ways from your home territory, but they wanted to build a municipal network. They did not have a municipal electric department, which is very common among citywide municipal networks, and they reached out to you. And you were essential in helping them to get educated, get inspired, pass a referendum with 74% support, and get the network built.
We enjoyed our association with Monticello, even though I suppose everybody would look and say, well, it certainly didn't end in a place where you expected. And while that's true, I think we learned a couple of things. We learned some very valuable things there. And interestingly enough, sometimes the things you know best, you can forget about. You know, as we built Winona, it was extremely important that we were local. And our successes were based largely on the fact that, you know, our friends and acquaintances became our customers. As we got north of the Twin Cities, that wasn't quite so evident. And finding the employee base that could take on the HBC culture was difficult, even that far from home. You know, we're sitting here in Cannon Falls, and Cannon Falls, the bank that we're in, has an affiliation with the bank in Winona. And I remember the merchant CEO saying to me once, you know, when we're able to install our own person in the banks we acquire, we do really well. When we have to go with someone who isn't familiar, we don't do as well because it's a cultural issue. And so I think some of the problems we had in Monticello that ultimately resulted in our withdrawal from the project and sort of a difficult then transition for Monticello, I wish could have been avoided. Probably made sense for both areas, and I'm pleased that the network is seemingly running well today.
I think that it shows a character of a person. When you take a project that came to an unsatisfactory conclusion, one in which I know from personal experience had both what we might call endogenous problems and exogenous problems, as the fancy economists like to say, which yes. is to say problems on the inside with what you and Monticello did and problems on the outside.
That's correct.
One of the biggest problems Monticello faced was that Charter came in, and as I understand, and some numbers were provided to me back in the day, Charter began offering an insane deal, the best deal that they've offered anywhere, to my knowledge. They took a product that was $145 a month everywhere else in the state, and they reduced it to $60 per month. It was every channel, the fastest broadband speeds they had available, $60 a month guaranteed rate for 2 years. Clearly, losing money on every single subscriber who took that every month. Now, you could have said that first, but instead you noted some of the things that you said, because I know the growth really dropped off a cliff at that point.
Well, it did. That started as we were there, but really accelerated after the decision for us to go away. You know, I expect when that started, Charter might have been worried about, well, what are they going to do next? We had obviously hurt them badly in Winona, and we were about to hurt them in Red Wing. It was kind of interesting to me, you know, Charter closed all of its local offices, and the first one it opened again was in Red Wing as we were building that network. There were a lot of those problems. But I also think that we were some of the problem. And when I say we, it's because local knowledge is critically important. I don't think we had as much of that as we should have. There was another thing, too, and that is because we didn't have it, the city was more interested in providing advice than we were interested in listening. Hindsight being what it is, we probably should have listened more, and they perhaps should have given less advice. But I'm pleased that the network is still operating and seems, I think, to be doing well. I also retained some friends from Monticello, including Jeff O'Neill, who is the city administrator there. And
anywhere that I would live, I would like to have him as the city administrator. He puts his heart and soul into it.
He really does. He's a very good man. I'm pleased that I got to know him.
It's worth noting that the project did not succeed financially. There was a struggle with the bonds. On the other hand, from the perspective of local businesses, prior to you and Monticello doing this, they were sending their employees home in the afternoons to work from home because their offices were incapable of supporting, in 2008, a modern workforce.
That's absolutely correct.
Now they have far better connectivity than I can get anywhere in St. Paul.
That's an advantage of the vision. You know, people always talk about money. And to me, money's not nearly as important as vision. If you have the vision to do something that is critically needed and no one has stepped up to do, generally speaking, you can find the money to get it done. If I had my choice between vision and money, I'd take vision. Maybe that's because I don't have money, but
I'm not. Well, it's worth reminding people. I mean, I think some people might hear that and cynically think, well, government is always just going to find money by picking someone else's pocket. It would be the most uncharitable way of saying it. But you're saying that as a perspective of a business owner as well.
I am.
The vision is the most important thing.
Absolutely. You know, I think back to the first seeds of HBC, and the first call I got from the founder of Fastenal saying, I think we should look at this new thing called fiber optics. And, you know, it demonstrated to me that a good business person is very much aware of the things happening, even if it would appear that there would be no help in it for that particular business.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So if we move on a little bit, and actually this is happening concurrently, you started working with City of North St. Paul, which is a small suburb. It really has its own independent character north of St. Paul, Minnesota. And there, I'll just briefly summarize, I think Comcast may have done you a bit of a favor because you hadn't yet learned the lessons from Monticello. The City of North St. Paul was very arrogant almost, very confident in their capacity to pass the referendum, to move forward with a project with you. And Comcast went all out. There was buses that seemed to have been sponsored by Comcast.
That's my understanding, too.
Taking people to the polls, and the only thing that those people knew was they were supposed to vote no, and I don't know what they got in return, but it must have been nice.
Obviously, the no vote carried the day. But again, that too was an interesting project. We were very interested in seeing if the formula that we thought could succeed would work in a metro area. Monticello was almost that because it was on the fringes of the Twin Cities. North St. Paul would have been deeper into that hub, but we didn't get the chance. It, too, though, was an interesting exercise because, as you say, they were very confident that the referendum would pass, and we had done a lot of work in the expectation that it would, too. So we learned that probably shouldn't count chickens before they're hatched, as the old saying goes, and took away from it some knowledge that would, I suppose, play a part in future developments. But I wish we could have done that project. I think you're right in saying that Comcast did us a favor. I'm not sure we could have been successful there given the attention the project would have gotten. You know, nibbling at Charter from Winona and Red Wing is different than nibbling at Comcast in North St. Paul.
Almost on top of the Capitol.
Well, right. And I'm sure everybody at Comcast saying, well, nobody in their right mind would just build North St. Paul. There's got to be a plan here to move on, right? Quite frankly, there had been some synergies between Roseville and North St. Paul. Yeah, we were looking at Roseville. So Comcast, I think, wisely thought we can't really allow this to happen.
Mm-hmm. So the next one that I'm aware of is Renville-Sibley. Is that the next one?
Well, actually, we had two others, well, three really, that the first one that we did, which was an outside-the-box maneuver, was to provide Ace Communication, a far southeastern Minnesota telephone co-op, with video signal. It was, for us, a very good partnership. I thought it was a good partnership for them, too. We cooperated on the purchase of equipment that was needed to redigitize signal to send it over a long haul, although people probably wouldn't see Winona to Houston as a long haul by today's standards. And in return, Ace was getting free signal until we paid off their share, or the share that they expended. For some reason, unexplainable to me, and I think in many ways totally unexplainable, they terminated the agreement long before they had managed to get their equity out of the project. And when it went to mediation, the finding was on the side of HBC. We would have much rather the project continued. But that was the first one. Ironically, and you're probably going to laugh at this, the second one was CenturyTel. We became a video provider for CenturyTel in La Crosse.
Yes, we did cover that in the previous interview.
Right, yep. And so we helped them get started in video. I think always knowing that if the experiment was successful, they would do something that would not encourage using HBC, and they did that. And we also helped another small cooperative on the Wisconsin side of the river, Cochrane Telephone, to provide video signal. So those were all in the mix before the RS Fiber Renville-Sibley project began. But that one appears, at least from my vantage point, to be cranking up well. I think HBC is doing the things it needs to do for that project to be successful. There's a pretty sizable HBC workforce and residents in those communities now. And that's pleasing to me, too. So another way, I guess, to grab the local knowledge that we might not otherwise have had.
You seem to have spent a lot of time helping Wisconsin communities for someone that I've seen enthusiastically tailgating Minnesota football games.
I you know, Chris, this is interesting because the first year I was married, I was the sports editor in Albert Lea, and the Wisconsin-Minnesota game was coming along, and both my wife and I had the flu. And the marriage almost ended during the game because Ellen was aggressively cheering for the Badgers.
No.
And doing a great job of ribbing me because, unfortunately, the Badgers won the game.
As they have almost every game for my lifetime.
That's correct. And I was cheering for the Gophers. I'm happy to say that Ellen today is just as big a Gopher fan as I am. So, I grew up in Wisconsin, though, and so there's not much difference except for the river that runs between us. The strips of land on either side are comprised of people who are much the same.
Those are the best rivalries, though.
Oh, they are. They surely are.
So the Renville Sibley Project, which listeners may be more familiar with as RS Fiber, ended up being a cooperative. And so the cooperative owns the physical assets and HBC's providing services over it. And I think you were a bit modest. The feeling I get in talking to people about RS Fiber is that HBC has gone above and beyond. In terms of making sure that things would happen correctly, really, really going beyond what would be expected of a partner.
Well, and you know, Chris, the project started under my tenure, but Dan Pecorina, the new CEO, is really the shepherd of what has happened. But to me, that's what always should happen. And I would like to think that it's an HBC habit to try and go above and beyond. It's part of Minnesota Nice, mm-hmm. I think, and it's part of the program that makes for successful ventures. I always felt that we should pour into projects all of the knowledge we had and as many resources as could legitimately be spent. HBC is more capable today than it was during my tenure. It's a much more successful company now. And I'm glad to hear you say that. That's very pleasing because I bumped into Toby Brummer. Toby was the head of a construction company, a tiny construction company that we purchased. And Toby is the resident manager. He lives, I think, in Winthrop. Toby's a happy guy. He's always been a happy guy, even when things were going wrong. And he loves it over there. He loves the people. He's a farmer, which fits very well, and I am very pleased that the project is going well.
One of the things that I feel like I've learned in watching, particularly from Monticello, I think as we look back at these different partnerships, these networks are hard to build on their own. There's some companies that make it look easier than others, but they are hard projects. And when you do a partnership, sometimes there's this naive belief that will make it easier because you're working with someone that has experience or is better at raising capital or whatever the partnership is based on. In my experience, when the going gets tough, which it inevitably does at one point or another for one reason or another, maybe it's technical, maybe it's competition, who knows, that puts stress on the partnership. And I feel like I've seen many more partnerships fold than many of the boosters of partnerships want to admit, because one side wasn't willing to say, you know what, the contract isn't really clear on this, but we're going to make it work. We're going to go beyond. Is that something you see?
I think that's a very accurate statement. We thought we had learned some things in Winona that could be helpful in Monticello. The Monticello people, trying to put the best spin on this, weren't in agreement. I mean, the one thing that we didn't want to do was get into a price war.
Agreed, yeah.
Because we thought that there was absolutely no way to survive it, and I don't think there is a way to survive that against a Charter or a Comcast.
They could give their product away for free, and the investors wouldn't notice a thing.
Absolutely the case. And it became difficult to try and serve the knowledge we had at the same time that we were trying to keep a partnership happy. And ultimately, the best decision was probably made for both parties.
So I want to talk about Burlington. I feel like we're just like in a major lessons learned podcast here. Burlington, which if people who are listeners haven't heard my interview with Stephen Barraclough, who was instrumental in working with Burlington during this time period, it may be some important context. But Burlington got into trouble. My read on it is that you had a mayor that came in after Burlington was being built. You're in a difficult period of expansion then. And the mayor put in someone to run Burlington Telecom that I think was very not transparent, was very opaque. And there were some problems, and that administration chose to hide those problems. And they got worse and worse until it spilled out in the public. And you have a need to invest more in the network. You have a network that didn't have enough customers. And you have a lot of frustration from the public when they learned about the problems that had been hidden from the city council.
Yeah, I'm going to take you back just a little bit. There was a gentleman that we both know, Tim Nolte, was the first CEO of the company. And I'm not sure, Chris, that I could exactly pinpoint for you the earliest problems with the system, but I remember we were asked to come in after money that the city didn't realize or the city council didn't realize had been spent, and the city capital lease money had also all been spent.
So Tim Nolte had been booted out more or less in 2007. You were brought in, 2009, yes.
Nine. And Bob Kiss was still the mayor. But he was to lose the next election because what happened shortly after we were brought in is the city defaulted on its capital lease with Citi.
Which is a terribly named company, and I'm always struggling to explain to people. So Citi, C-I-T-I,
Citibank.
Citibank, which then labeled itself Citi, and I think lent money to Burlington without doing its proper due diligence in
Correct.
Retrospect.
Yeah. The first thing, as we looked at it, there were three of us who went to Burlington. We were to do a study of the network.
You got blue ribbons for it. There's a blue ribbon committee, was my recollection.
Yes, you're right. But in any event, what we discovered was a network that no one in their right mind would have built, in our opinion. A network that cost several times too much, that exhausted the limited funds, and there laid a network that may have had the greatest potential for success of any I have ever seen, that was built in a way that no one, in my opinion, of a right mind would have built. There was almost a home run, if you will, to every dwelling in Burlington. So what we're talking about in home run is a dedicated line from the head end facility to the customer, which is not something that you find anywhere that I'm aware of. Maybe you know of.
There's a few. I mean, usually in a city the size of Burlington, you would expect that even if you were using home run type technology, it would be to an aggregation point in a neighborhood or something
Correct.
Like that. And I think the main concern is the incredible cost of fiber versus using some kind of technology in which you would oversubscribe more in the fiber by using a passive optical networking or something like
Correct.
That.
So just as we finished our study, the mayoral election took place, and we had a new mayor to work with, and made a bad mistake in my first meeting because I told the mayor that, in my opinion, he had a magnificent asset on his hands that could become successful if it were managed and operated correctly. And I don't really think the mayor wanted to hear that, because I think that there was a great frustration in Burlington that led to an opinion that the best thing to do with the network was to sell it, if in fact it could be sold, and just get out of the business.
Tim Nolte, who I still consider a friend.
Yeah, and so do I.
I think Tim would have said that yes, he built it in that way to be future-proof, and he would justify that and say that the network would have been fine under his tenure if they had had a proper marketing campaign and things like that. One of the things that I understood during the KISS administration, and this is a quote that when we were investigating, trying to figure out what had happened, because we have a very strong interest in learning when municipal fiber networks struggle, we want to know why. So we were investigating it, and someone told me that you could have moved into many parts of Burlington over the course of several years and never have even known that that was an option to get Burlington telecom fiber. So I think, like many things, there's root causes that different people can point to, and then they all conspire together to create a real big problem.
That's correct. Burlington Telecom had done little to attract customers to the network, and that was a critical missing link. You know, I wouldn't have built the network that Tim built, but on the other hand, we could sit across this desk from each other and carry on a very friendly argument about the situation.
It's worth noting that I have yet to find two people that would build the same network. There are extremes. I think HBC has found ways of building networks at as low a cost as possible, and that's been a part of your success. And I think, you know, Tim tends to build them in his way, and he has his reasons. There's a lot of people in the middle that have still different ways of building networks. So people who are listening to this shouldn't be surprised when they hear these kinds of disagreements. But you should be aware that if you commit to a very expensive network, you sure have to find a way of bringing customers onto it quickly.
Well, which means that you had better plan marketing expenditures very carefully, because mm-hmm. you're going to need them. You know, at the time we got there, the $17 million fiasco had broken. The Citibank fiasco was out in the public. Everything that you could imagine going wrong was going wrong. And if you walked into the BT office, you saw a group of people with their heads down, reluctant, quite frankly, to look up. And, you know, Stephen came to the party after we had concluded our first run. And then Stephen asked me to come out and spend a couple days with him talking about our analysis, and then asked if we would stay on and help. There were so many hurdles to cross, and I'm pleased to see the company now upright. It still has a way to go.
You and I disagreed on who should buy it when they sold it, but like other things, we agree amicably, and we both desperately hope that it succeeds and expands.
I do indeed, and you know, I must say that you probably, well, you clearly knew more about your choice than I did, and. And I am not going to suggest that I knew more about my choice than you did. But I think with the right leadership, that can be a successful property. I think what it needs, they're going to need a fair amount of resource. They're sitting in the middle of a wonderful situation. I mean, you know, you have 150,000 people in the county, of which Burlington is the
mighty Chittenden County.
Chittenden County. And so Winooski, you know, South Burlington, all of those communities could become part of that network.
Yeah, these are people that do not like global corporations like
Correct.
Comcast.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely the case. And so I think the right leadership will take them a long way and ultimately will make the city whole again and will also demonstrate business viability at the same time that the right kind of leadership will have customer satisfaction as a key goal. You know, I don't think you can go into a competitive situation and operate like the incumbent and expect to succeed.
No, the incumbents win by inertia.
Absolutely. And so you have to identify every flaw that competition has, and you have to work to exploit every single one of them.
Right. One of the things that we have been wondering about is how many small companies and municipalities really advertise like their difference in privacy policies, for instance. Like, when was the last time HBC sold customer data to a third party?
Yeah, never.
Yeah, exactly.
Never, and never would it happen, I'm convinced. Well, probably shouldn't say never, but I don't
It's hard to imagine why it would.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because for a small company like that, your reputation is everything. And the little bit of money you would make from it is not that much. But if you're a Comcast and you have 18, 22, 30 million customers, however
Absolutely.
Many they have, you can make a lot of money and most of your customers don't have another choice. So
correct.
So I want to round out by talking a little bit more widely about policy. Minnesota has the Blandin Foundation, which is somewhat unique and has been tremendously positive. And I think there's been a couple of negative side effects to the overwhelmingly positive benefits of Blandin. But you've been on the Blandin board for probably forever.
I mean, well, I'm no longer a member of the board.
You had been.
I was from the earliest days.
And this was a Blandin broadband board.
It was. It was. Not the foundation board.
What did they do? Well, I mean, tell me a little bit about the beginning of that and the strategies for how to set the stage. Blandin is a foundation that's very focused on greater Minnesota, the non-metro regions. They helped to send my wife to college, and I met her in grad school, so I'll be forever indebted to Blandin for that.
And they had a leadership program that had, at least in our area of the state, made their name known. They identified the broadband area as an area of potential for Minnesota. And I think most of our early efforts, Chris, were expended on trying to convince state government that it ought to be active in the broadband area. As government usually does, it didn't move as fast as we hoped it would. Some of the things that we lobbied hard for, we'd get a sliver, but certainly not the whole pie. And so ultimately, Blandin switched strategy to trying to do it more with the people who would benefit. I thought that was a very good move. It concentrated mostly on planning and helping communities plan initiatives.
And that's where I really wanted to dig in a little bit. I mean, I think when I look at Blandin, there's a number of things that they have done. One is, I think Ann Treacy's work on the Blandin blog is tremendous.
It is.
And I don't think a lot of people appreciate how important it is to have a place that is cataloging on a daily basis, talking about these sorts of things so people can understand what's happening. And Anne has been, coming from a family of librarians, you can tell.
she's wonderful.
So one of the things that when people sometimes ask me for advice about what other states should do, I often say that Blandin has been incredibly successful in the planning part by offering matching grants. Their communities have to commit something, but it gives a real edge to those in the community that want something to happen because they can say, look, we're getting this great deal from Blandin. They're going to match the cost of this study, and that is going to help convince city councils to appropriate a little bit of money to do it. We're talking about usually on the order of $10,000 to $15,000, which is then matched by Blandin.
Right. If I had to look at the broader issue and beware of sweeping generalities, but I think that many of our city governments are populated by people my age or not too much younger than I am. And we didn't grow up with the connectivity that we have today, and we didn't grow up understanding it or caring much either. And I think that victimizes us. I think there's a problem in Minnesota today. I think it's that too few young people are really getting involved in the governmental activity in their local communities.
Preach. And, totally agree.
And the fact of the matter is it hurts us in many ways, but I think it hurts us particularly in the broadband area. And, I think Blandon's wonderful. I remember Heather Gold talking to me once about she had just come to her position in the Broadband Association. I suggested she look at Blandon as a model, and now there is a toolkit that's very similar to the Blandon toolkit that's being used nationally.
Right. This is the fiber to the home primer, for which was just updated in late 2017.
That's correct.
It's terrific.
Yes, absolutely terrific. And Blandon's impact has been solid, but quite frankly, should be much greater.
Well, this is where, when we sat down and started warming up the mics before we recorded, I said something. I wasn't sure how you would react, and that is, I feel that we started talking about the rural electrification, Red Wing, Minnesota being the first REA site. And my impression from studying that period is electrification happened quickly and in such a great way with these co-ops that have been so good for rural America because local communities organize them. And I still see, in my greatest criticism of Blandon, not just, I don't want to centralize on Blandon, but everyone in Minnesota working on broadband issues, is it's so focused on getting the state to do something. There's not enough focus on getting communities to do something so that when state money's available, it could be put to good use.
We were also talking about the value of vision versus money. Mm-hmm. If I had to look at your statement, I would say you're right. Clearly you're right. But it might be that Blandon's concentration has been where it's been because it determined that it wasn't going to have the kind of support out there, mm-hmm. if you will, that maybe it could find in 400 or 500 legislators in St. Paul. It is a real worry because as we went to the tiny communities, if you will, to receive franchises, there was only one thing that people wanted to talk about, and that was cable TV pricing. Will you sell it to us for less money? And nobody was thinking about what this could do for their community and how to make it just as powerful as rural electrification was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really want to reiterate that Blandon has been not just net positive, but incredibly net positive. And I don't want to say that because it's worth noting, Blandon was right on open access, I think, 12 years ago. I mean, when they started pushing open access, the carriers really resisted it. I think that would have been very good for Minnesota. I continue to be a believer in open access approaches. Blandon has had these conferences and employed Bill Coleman to really educate communities on what these words mean and the importance of economic development in broadband. It's had events that it has put on despite the opposition and undercutting of the rural telephone companies in Minnesota, which I find really dismaying. I understand that we have some differences of opinion, but we all have to work together to solve this problem. So I would say that in terms of we want to talk about what Blandon might be able to do better or differently. If anyone from Blandon is listening to this, they should take heart that they've done a tremendous job of moving Minnesota forward.
Absolutely. You know, I might think about painting with a brush not so broad, if you will. I mean, if you could identify in advance through some process the communities committed to doing something, then the relatively small resource you have might be deployed more effectively. You know, I would go to communities and I would say to them, folks, every community where there today is an HBC network is larger than it was when the network was built. Now, don't you think that message would resonate with people? And then, you know, those who were not interested would, but it costs too much, and where are we going to get the money? And it always came down to that. And you know, and the St. Charles lesson to me was absolutely incredible.
The community, not the saint.
Yeah, right.
Just for people who haven't mentioned it yet, this episode, but St. Charles is one of the first HBC towns you moved out to.
It was, and we had no interest in doing that until their Economic Development Association came to us and knew clearly why it wanted us there. They wanted us there because they wanted to be the number one bedroom community to Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
To suggest that they have been unsuccessful in that goal would be absolutely wrong. Now, are they the number one bedroom community to Rochester? Well, I'm sure Byron would argue Pine Island might, Orinoco might. But the fact of the matter is that St. Charles is significantly larger today than it was. It has more business than it did then.
It doesn't have the geographical advantages of all the other places you noted that are closer.
I think that, you know, St. Charles has done a magnificent job. And once again, it was the issue of vision.
Well, and I would just say we talked about Renville Sibley without mentioning Mark Erickson.
Oh, Mark.
Here's someone who talked about vision and stamina for 5 years against struggle after struggle, where one pathway was closed off after another. And he, I still think of him as the heart of a group of people that all deserve endless praise for the work that they did. Mark, I just feel like he wasn't going to give up.
Well, you know, it didn't start in Renville Sibley County. Mark, as the city administrator, wanted his community to succeed. I remember him dragging me to Seattle and Microsoft early in the HBC existence.
This was back when Mark worked for HBC.
No.
Oh.
Mark was the city administrator.
Fairfield or very close to there?
It was south of
Wyndham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Mark ultimately was dismissed as city administrator because of people being disappointed with the fact that too much activity and money was being spent on connectivity. Then he came to work for HBC. Then he got interested. He wanted to go back to his roots, and he moved to Winthrop as city administrator. Then became economic development director and stepped out as city administrator, but...
And now he's somewhere in Europe, I think, right, this week.
Touring.
Touring. Yeah.
He promised me he'd call when he got back, but it's been a while since his retirement party. But, you know, Mark was tremendous. He was absolutely untiring in his efforts to get his communities to understand the importance of broadband, and the Renville Sibley project is exclusively due to him.
It is worth noting that, again, this wasn't just a disappointment occasionally of a plan not working out. There were people that were undermining him. There's still a whisper campaign that he's getting paid under the table millions of dollars from you HBC, which is ridiculous.
That was also a rumor at the time that HBC or that ACE backed away from our partnership. And, you know, it's so ridiculous. Apparently, people just like to look for things to complain about. But Mark is someday going to be recognized by those communities as having done them an enormous favor.
Yes, and a lot of people already credit him with that. And I do want to note, if Mark was here, he would be both blushing and stammering and saying, no, it wasn't me, it was other people. People were essential to making it happen, but if you had to pick one person, that the keystone,
there's no question it was Mark.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been another great edition of the Minnesota history, I think, of how we've moved forward a bit, the role that HBC has played, the role that you've played in your own personal role in some cases.
Well, you know, I was raised by my grandmother, who used to have her hands full. Shouldn't have had to raise another generation after her own, but Grandma always told me that the only thing I needed to worry about was always leaving the things I touched better than they were when I found them. And I hope someday somebody will say, you know, he did that. I hope someday when I see Grandma, she'll tell me I did that. Chances are she'll find some fault with how I did it, however.
Always room for improvement.
Always.
Well, thank you, Gary, for another hour of your time. I greatly appreciate it, and looking forward to finding more things to talk about in the future.
Good. Chris, as always, it's a pleasure. I've had more fun than you have. So.
Thank you.
That was Christopher with Gary Evans, former president and CEO of Hiawatha Broadband Communications in southeastern Minnesota. For more about the company, visit hbci.com. You can also check out our coverage on muninetworks.org at the HBC tag. We have transcripts for this and other podcasts available at muninetworks.org/broadbandbits. Email us at podcast@muninetworks.org with your ideas for the show. Follow Chris on Twitter. His handle is @communitynets. Follow muninetworks.org stories on Twitter. The handle is @muninetworks. Subscribe to this podcast and the other ILSR podcasts, Building Local Power and the Local Energy Rules podcast. You can access them on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Never miss out on our original research by also subscribing to our monthly newsletter at ilsr.org. Thanks again to Arnie Huseby for the song Warm Duck Shuffle, licensed through Creative Commons. And thanks for listening to episode 302 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast.